Last night, we had the COSA roundtable that preceded this, and we had a really nice group get together. We had about 100 people attend that. We had food donated by Organic Valley, and it was a really nice event. And we always have a lot of discussion during those COSA roundtables, and it really got me thinking that we need to do some type of blog, because I think the kind of discussion that we had at that roundtable could be continued for on and on, and a blog would be one way to do that, and that's something that COSA is going to look into. I know we already have it set up for the COSA website. It's just something we really haven't kept up on. So that might be a new opportunity to weigh in on some of these questions about organic and sustainable agriculture. So as far as our symposium today, this was organized primarily by COSA with other sponsors from the tri-societies assisting us. And the co-sponsors are the Council on the History, Philosophy, and Sociology of Soil Science. They don't have an individual symposium this year as they normally do. And the Integrated Agricultural Systems is also a sponsor. And then the International Union of Soil Science Commission, which is also a history, philosophy, and sociology of soil science at the international level organization. Here's some of the information that was in our application when COSA applied to hold this. I mean, we were looking at it from the standpoint that we needed to look at some of the social aspects of organic farming. Particularly why and how people care so deeply about the kind of foods that they want to consume. And then how this has become a consumer choice social movement, and it's providing incentives for farmers to transition to their farmland into more sustainable organic systems. It's changing their farming practices, in effect. And so this is the kind of information we need to also look at as soil scientists and agronomists, is what's going on out there socially. It's been a while since we've actually published a book about organic farming in the tri-societies. The last one was after a symposium in 1981 that was concerned with organic farming. And they published a book called Organic Farming, Current Technology and Its Role in Sustainable Agriculture. Well, this current symposium also is here to celebrate and highlight the fact that there's a new publication, a new book has just been published, Organic Farming, the Ecological System. In this symposium, we have a number of sociologists speaking, and we have an attorney, our last speaker. But also we have members from the societies here, agronomist and soil scientist. And I want to really recognize our sponsors here, because this would not have been possible without raising funds to bring in these invited speakers that have to pay a registration fee in order to speak. And we want to reimburse them, and so we were able to raise almost $10,000 from these various organizations. The Pennsylvania Association of Sustainable Agriculture has been extremely helpful, and our speaker that has come from New Zealand, Hugh Campbell. The Weston A. Price Foundation provided a significant amount of funding for two speakers, and then Organic Valley provided the food for the COSA roundtable yesterday evening. And Fertrail, one of the oldest, I think the oldest, organic fertilizer company, provided funding for the speaker from Rodale. The Western Sierra region provided $2,000, and the Northeast Sierra is funding one of the speakers. And then the Organic Farming Research Foundation provided a level of funding also for the COSA roundtable yesterday evening. So we want to thank all of those sponsors that made this possible. Well, I'm going to begin, and I'm also going to be serving as a moderator and first speaker. And I'm a soil scientist. I work on soil fertility at Rutgers University. I'm not a sociologist, but I'm going to be talking about social aspects of organic farming, as in the perspectives on the history, philosophy, and sociology of organic farming. Currently, there are about 20,000 organic farming operations in the United States, but in 1956, Organic Gardening and Farming magazine reported only 150 organic farms as places to visit. My father's organic farm in Yorkshire, Ohio, where he raised corn, wheat, and milking shorthorn cattle, was one of those farms. During World War II, when Dad was in the Army and stationed in Europe, a fellow soldier loaned him a copy of Plowman's Folly. That book inspired him to look into organic farming. Shortly after returning home from the war, he married his sweetheart and began his farming career. Around 1950, he converted to organic farming. I'm one of 12 children raised on that 100-acre organic farm. I provide this background because this experience naturally influences my perspectives on the history, philosophy, and sociology of organic farming. That's not me on the 1950 cover of Organic Farmer magazine. I was born in 1956. The various Rodale publications were familiar reading materials in our house. Reading them got me interested in soil fertility. Bearing witness to the events of the organic movement also sparked my interest in the history of soil science. Where I was once serving as chair of the Soil Science Society of America Council on the History, Philosophy, and Sociology of Soil Science, I wrote a paper about a history of organic farming, which you can find easily on the web if you just Google organic farming history. And I don't want to repeat what I talked about there. And I'm going to be moving on into new territory. But I wrote that paper because I felt that Howard's work was underappreciated. What can we learn from the study of the history of science? One often finds human social structures, struggles that run in parallel with advancements in science. Can organic farming help agronomists better understand how to serve the organic community? Yes, I think it certainly can, and that is one of the objectives of this symposium. When one looks at the organic perspective in contrast to the conventional perspective, as outlined in this table, one sees a dichotomy across every dimension. I have time to address only a few of these items in my presentation today. I will show this slide once more at the end. I first want to describe the work of some of the organic pioneers and what they each contributed to the cultural practices and organic philosophy. I want to discuss some of these before going on to discuss some of the ongoing struggles in the organic movement. Albert Howard is the most prominent figure in the organic movement. Of course, he did not consciously set out to establish an alternative system of agriculture. Rather, his significant contributions to the organic system largely evolved out of his agricultural research experiences in India. He appears neutral on the subject of chemical fertilizers in his early writings, but later becomes strongly opposed. Howard was inspired by the work of F.H. King, who wrote a book called Farmers of 40 Centuries, and also by the compost-based farming system that was used by the Hunzas. He made significant contributions to the science of composting and promotes the law of return philosophy, where all natural waste materials were collected in composting as being crucial to building soil fertility. His observations on plant and animal health in connection with humus-rich soil led him to become a loud critic of using synthetic chemicals in agriculture. I believe that much of the ever-growing sustainability movement is actually an offshoot of the organic movement that carried this concept along for decades before it became popular. Here at this conference, we have a lot of emphasis on sustainability. That's great. And I added the picture there because there's one container that's missing from that, and that is compostables. That should be added. And if this was a PASA conference, the Pennsylvania Association of Sustainable Agriculture, that's actually something they do. They collect the compostables and it's composted. So there's still more that we can do. And then last night at the COSA roundtable, there was a lot of discussion about human manure use and organic farming. That was something that was actually talked about and was recommended, if it's done properly, as a sustainable practice historically. But then sewage sludge today isn't permitted in organic farming. Well, F.H. King published that book about 100 years ago and provided the spark that inspired the organic pioneers in this more sustainable direction. Robert McCarlson was a medical doctor from England. He studied the Hunzas. He observed exceptionally good health in the people who lived in the mountainous region of northern India. Their farming systems relied on carefully composting all available waste materials. They lived by the law of return soil fertility principle. They also lived on whole, unprocessed, traditional foods. Dr. McCarlson was extremely impressed by the health of the Hunzas in contrast to the people he knew in England who consumed modern foods, sugar, white flour, etc. When Weston A. Price, a dentist from Cleveland, Ohio, he set out to travel the world during the 1930s to study over a dozen isolated indigenous peoples who were still eating their traditional diets and enjoyed vibrant health. His work influenced the thinking of many organic pioneers. He observed that so long as people consumed their traditional diets, they had excellent teeth, physical condition, and overall health. But health declined quickly whenever their traditional diets were replaced by what Price called the displacing foods of commerce. The Weston A. Price Foundation is an organization dedicated to his teaching and is one of the sponsors for this symposium. In the 1930s, there was a growing interest in the related subject areas of soil fertility, food quality, and health. A word was needed to bridge what Howard described as the whole problem of health in soil, plant, animal, and man as one great subject. The word organic was about to find a new application in relation to a system of farming and food. Walter Northborn is considered as being the first person to use organic in this context. In 1940, he published Look to the Land, in which he elaborated on the idea of the farm as an organic whole. He wrote that an organic farm must have a biological completeness. It must be a living entity where every branch of work is interlocked with all others. This concept extended to food and health. In the philosophical sense, organic refers to wholeness. In 1939, Eve Balfour launched the first long-term comparison side-by-side farming experiment. She reports on the experimental findings and further defines organic concepts in terms of wholeness in her book, The Living Soil. Her thinking was influenced by the works of Albert Howard, Robert McCarlson, and Weston Price, among others. By 1940, Howard's writings were spreading and finding a readership around the world. J.I. Rodale, an American businessman, was most impressed by Howard and was inspired to buy a rundown farm near Allentown, Pennsylvania, and convert it to organic. In 1942, he began publishing Organic Farming and Gardening magazine. In the first volume, he wrote, "One of these fine days, the public is going to wake up and will pay for eggs, meat, vegetables, etc., according to how they are produced." Well, that day has arrived, and certainly the Rodale Institute continues to play an important role in the organic movement. By the late 1940s, organic and conventional were engaged in a war of words. In 1948, Rodale publishes a book, The Organic Front, shortly after Howard's last book was called War in the Soil, in effect, expanding that war motif to the United States. Rodale wrote a book about the Hunza, and he was well aware of the work of Weston Price. He believed that healthy indigenous peoples that were discovered around the world were a validation of the organic model. Another example of the organic message diffusing around the world. Now, remember, this is before the internet, just a correspondence here, exchange of letters, is given by this letter from A.S. Neal, who was a headmaster at Summerhill School in England. And he's writing to Dr. Wilhelm Reich, who's living in the United States. Of late, I've taken up in an amateurish way scientific agriculture. Neal goes on to describe his efforts at making compost. I am most interested in the ideas of Sir Albert Howard, who says that all the spraying of trees and with tobacco, mercury, etc., is wrong, and merely treating symptoms. He traces all plant diseases back to poor soil and manures, and says that in India he had cows on grass artificially manured, and they took foot and mouth disease. Within the next field, he had cows on naturally manured pasture, and they rubbed noses over the fence with infected cows, but none of them contracted the disease. A few weeks later, Wilhelm Reich writes back, "Your discourse on manure and foot and mouth disease was a great help. I understood suddenly from what you told about Howard's work that the chemical industries are not only not curing disease, but more, they are creating disease, and I'm going right ahead to clear that question." Dr. Reich was a medical doctor with wide-ranging research interests, including agriculture. I do not yet know how far Dr. Reich pursued the organic question, but there may be something in the archives which have recently opened for research at the Harvard Library of Medicine. A recent journal article concerning the sociology of alternative agriculture observed that members of the eco-agricultural network focus on the energetic signals given by crop plants and not infrequently cite the works of maverick medical doctors such as Dr. Wilhelm Reich. For an understanding of the history of science, it is useful to place events in the context of the times. In 1961, Time magazine lauded the age of science. Much of the world marveled in technical optimism. Pesticides were the miracles of chemistry. Atomic power was too cheap to meter. And agriculture was in the midst of the Green Revolution. Conventional agricultural scientists, as early as 1947, felt a need to respond to its critics. Dr. Furman Baer, head of the Soils Department at Rutgers University, defends conventional agriculture and refers to the organic pioneers as gloomy prophets. Others began to declare organic farming a cult. But in 1962, Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, was published. This ignites the environmental movement and spurs a reversal of pesticide policy. Although Carson was neutral on organic farming, her book was a great help to the organic farming movement. But in 1970, Charles Walters began publishing Acres USA magazine. My father was an avid reader. It gives the voice to many types of alternative agriculture. Walters liked to call his view of organic farming eco-agriculture. After traveling a rocky road, the organic movement eventually gains formal recognition. In 1990, organic farming becomes codified in federal law as the USDA National Organic Program. But definitions and standards remain unsettled and will likely remain in a state of evolution. Many people say that the thought process is different in organic farming than in conventional. This may, in fact, be one of the greatest obstacles to organic transition and organic research. When I authored a chapter in the new book, Organic Farming, the Ecological System, I remember struggling with this thought process, the need to think about the whole system and avoiding the input substitution approach. The New Nitrogen Cycle, published in that book, at least attempts to depict a whole well-integrated organic farm. You can stop by my poster on Wednesday to see more detail about this. Howard thought of nature as a model of farming. Before there was the word organic farming, Howard liked to refer to it as nature's farming. He expressed the need for biodiversity and integration when he wrote, "Mother Earth never attempts to farm without livestock. She always raises mixed crops," and so on. Typical thought processes associated with conventional agriculture are listed here. Input substitution, for example, a separation between crop and livestock. Machines serve as the model. Parts are often studied in isolation. There's much focus on details of structure, as in molecular biology. A focus on how things differ. And attempts to be objective by excluding feelings. But I should add here that it's never possible to fully exclude them anyway, and it's more honest to just be acknowledge that the feelings are there, always. Typical thought processes associated with organic agriculture are listed here. Nature or living organisms serve as the model, organic wholeness, how things are alike or the looking for common functioning principles, functions of parts studied in relation to other functions in a unified wholeness of existence, and feelings and subjective impressions are not excluded. Yet there's an attempt, at least, to objectify the observations and findings by doing experiment. We live in a world increasingly concerned with environmental degradation. The problems are compounded by an inability to think as nature functions. What is the origin of this mechanical way of thinking? Wilhelm Reich thought that the problem of mechanical thinking is associated with emotional armoring. A recent book, Rebels, Mavericks, and Heretics in Biology, quotes Dr. Reich for a description of mechanical thinking in Armored Man. What is called civilized man is in fact angular, machine-like, without spontaneity. It has developed into an automation and a brain machine. Man not only believes that he functions like a machine, he does in fact function like a machine. He lives, loves, hates, and thinks like a machine, with his biological rigidity and the loss of natural function of self-regulation. I traced this passage back to The Mass Psychology of Fascism. That's a book that Wilhelm Reich wrote in 1933 based on his observations of what was going on in Nazi Germany. But going back even further, what are the origins then of emotional armoring that leads to mechanical thinking? In 2006, James DeMail was a speaker at these meetings and talked about his Saharasia thesis. In his book, Saharasia, he describes and maps global social human behavior and traces the origins of emotional armoring and patriarchy to over 4,000 years ago to a time of climate change. In general, matriarchy is associated with peaceful behavior, and patriarchy is associated with warfare and violence. With this in mind, note that pest management in conventional agriculture has a military mindset that is often apparent in the aggressive names given to pesticides and the technology it employs in a war with nature. This troubled human relationship with nature has been described in a book called The Death of Nature by environmental historian Carolyn Merchant. Her book places women clearly in the ecological equation. Before the scientific revolution, nature was conceptualized as female, as in Mother Nature. The earth was viewed as a living organism, that is to say, organic. Self-imposed limits were placed on once were placed on what one was allowed to do to nature. Note here the similarity with the restrictions by the organic standards, which does place restrictions on what can be done on an organic farm. Carolyn Merchant argues that the scientific revolution and the machine age changed our concept of nature. It reconceptualized nature and living organisms as just complex machines that could be manipulated without limits. She argues for a need to replace the ethic of mechanistic science with a sustainable partnership. She sees organic agriculture as part of this social reconstruction. Have you ever noticed that organic husbandry seems to attract women and men equally? In contrast to conventional farming, this is a pesticide meeting, for example, shown in that picture, where there is a heavy emphasis on chemicals and machines, agriculture remains very much male-dominated. Just notice the contrasting demographics next time you attend a conference of either type of agriculture. In short, organic agriculture appears to be more egalitarian, more aligned with matriarchy, and conventional agriculture more aligned with patriarchy. Now, for a perspective on some of the core values of organic, I now want to return to Alward Howard in his last and perhaps most passionately written book, where I think he spells out what is most at stake in organic farming. Because organic farming is more than just about a production system. He declares that the war in the soil is a result of a conflict between the birthright of humanity, and I'm going to place emphasis here, fresh food from fertile soil, and the profits of a section of big business in the shape of the manufacturers of artificial fertilizers and their satellite companies who produce the poison sprays to protect the crops and pests from pest and prepare the various remedies for the diseases of livestock and mankind. In a few words, the phrase fresh food from fertile soil captures the essence of organic and the main concerns of the organic pioneers who thought about organic as beyond production. It was also about food quality. Soil fertility has been primarily focused on defining character of the organic tradition and the organic system of agriculture. A connection of food quality to soil fertility naturally followed in the minds of the organic pioneers. For studies on soil fertility and food quality in organic farming, it is useful to look for a common functioning principle. There are remarkable ecological similarities in the organic system for feeding soil or feeding people. The emphasis on the living aspects, as in raw, unprocessed, and fermented foods in both areas. Contrast this with the approach with conventional or mechanical thinking, where the emphasis is reductionist, or chemistry rather than wholeness. There have been a number of studies comparing food quality of organic versus conventional, as for example, this article in CSA News. Except for pesticide differences, nutrient concentrations in plant products are generally unremarkable. But again, this is by using a reductionist approach. Few studies have used animal feeding trials, a more holistic approach, to examine the issue. But a summary from one review article from the UK states that, based on the data available from controlled animal feeding studies, the evidence appears moderately strong to suggest organic feed may have beneficial effects on animal health, particularly with respect to reproduction and pregnancy outcome. Before moving on, I must interject here that at least in case of the animal products or animal foods, such as meat, milk, and eggs, there are clear measurable nutritional differences between organic versus conventional, provided the organic system is pasture-based and the conventional represents the dominant confinement model. Pasture here is the vital component of the organic system, the value of which was long ago recognized by Weston A. Price. In the case of eggs, the difference is visible and noticeable, especially in the color of the egg yolk. Does freshness and quality really matter that much? Organic pioneers certainly thought so. As an example, in 1958, Rodale proclaimed loudly that it is not organic to produce milk organically and then pasteurize it. In the book, Look to the Land, Walter Northbourne wrote, "So long as people go on being fooled by advertisement, blatant or concealed, of processed foods, so long as they and the farmers be at the mercy of vast distributing concerns whose every interest seems to be opposed to the people, real nutritional necessities, how can it be otherwise in a world of specialization and urbanization? Effective distribution seems to necessitate sterilization, which means killing, for the failure to sterilize may mean infection in bulk, hence the outcry for pasteurization of milk. But sterilization reduces the resistance to infection and the power of assimilation of the consumer to that which is sterilized. So yet more sterilizing seems to be necessary. A vicious circle again, and a type which should by now be familiar." I think these ideas and words are worth revisiting in dealing with food safety issues, such as the hygiene hypothesis. In conventional thinking, killing pathogens is the focal point in disease control and food safety. In contrast, in organic farming, the primary focus is on developing healthy ecosystems that prevent or resist disease. I'm reading this book. Just last night, I found this quote, and I'm going to insert this here. The book is The Raw Milk Revolution, just published, and it captures this same line of thinking. To ensure the long shelf life, bacteria have got to go. All the foods our grandparents ate as fermented foods are now pasteurized. If food production industry tried to sell us on pasteurization as a way to enable the industry to consolidate and operate on a global scale, would you buy that? That is why they teach people to fear bacteria. Fear is a great motivator. Here's a simple experiment that I conducted. When not refrigerated, raw milk naturally ferments, whereas pasteurized milk putrefies and doesn't make good cheese either. If you look into the literature, there's actually a fair amount of research showing that fresh milk functions quite differently than pasteurized, homogenized milk. Shown here are the results of a feeding trial conducted at The Ohio State University in 1931. Rats fed pasteurized milk were anemic, had slow growth, rough coats, loss of vitality and weight, and were irritable, with a tendency to bite when handled. In 2008, Rutgers University held a seminar series to provide a forum to share information about raw milk. Mark McAfee from Organic Pastures Dairy was one of several speakers. Ever since I was involved in hosting those events, I've been inundated with this question: do you know a farmer? Do you know a farmer? Where can I get this special farm fresh organic food? So when Dr. Kathleen Merrigan, USDA Deputy Secretary, recently visited Rutgers University, I asked her about this. And I'll try to paraphrase what she had to say. She was aware of the huge underground network of raw milk sales. And she says some of it works very well and some of it does not. Just about a week ago, in Georgia, consumers who had legally purchased raw milk from a farm in South Carolina were ordered to dump it. Remember, Howard spoke about fresh food from fertile soil. Here the FDA orders dumping of fresh food onto soil. During the 1980s, summit meetings were held between organic and conventional groups. Once again, we need such a dialogue. Perhaps the widespread restoration of farm fresh raw milk as a staple food, the kind of food that we consumed since the dawn of agriculture, will one day become a reality and a new chapter in the history of the organic farming movement. Sally Fallon, president of the Weston A. Price Foundation, describes the current situation. 20 years ago, organic agriculture was a fringe movement, barely on the mainstream radar scope, a subject commentators treated with derision and politicians with scorn. Raw milk today is a fringe movement, a crusade of underdogs, a pesky mouse against the entrenched lions of medicine and industry. Today, organic food is in greater demand and more popular than ever, but food policy that demands or mandates unnecessary processing is increasingly restricting consumer freedom to enjoy truly authentic, farm-fresh, organic foods. Although the organic standards prohibit irradiation, they do not prevent pasteurization of organic almonds, as shown here, organic apple cider, or organic milk. Much concern has focused on the long-distance transport and its impact on food freshness, yet industrial processing may be doing even greater harm to food quality. One of the ecological philosophies of the organic system is that only natural, unrefined raw materials be used to feed the soil and build soil fertility. Another is the production of compost through the biological process of fermentation. In general, these same principles carry over to the management of organic foods in that they are ideally fresh, raw, minimally processed, or fermented. Thus, whether it is feeding soil or feeding people, the same general philosophy of avoiding harsh industrial processing technology applies. Sir Albert Howard expressed the hope that soil fertility would one day be the foundation of the public health system of the future. But such a vision requires that fresh food from fertile soil not be mishandled in its pathway to the people. In summary, if the abandonment of the organic perspective of nature and the adoption of a patriarchal attitude towards life, a machine to be manipulated and exploited for unrestrained industrial expansion, may be characterized as the death of nature, then perhaps the organic movement, which arguably holds a more matriarchal perspective, one that nurtures life by emulating natural ecology in the husbandry of soils, plants, animals, food, and people, may be characterized as an attempted rebirth of nature. Thank you for your attention. We have just a few minutes for questions. Oh, I said I was going to show this slide one more time. And this is about the dichotomies between the two systems of agriculture. And what I would add here, there's one thing that actually they're pretty much alike in, surprisingly, and that is yield or productivity. They're pretty similar. And what's remarkable about that is that's with a pittance of research. Yes?
Yeah, Joe, you mentioned bioenergetics and Wilhelm Reich. And question is, do you see any avenue where bioenergetic research in agriculture will come about in the land grant USDA research system, whether that be homeopathy or radionics or orgone, any related?
Well, I'm aware of work that's being done privately, but I don't know of any supported by the USDA other than there was a grant, I think a SARA grant some years ago, that supported the study of homeopathy. So that would be an example of a form of energetic, a life energy approach to research that was studied. If you consider homeopathy an energetic form of medicine, and I think that's arguably so. Yeah. Well, you bring up a really important area of discussion. The pasture issue is very contentious. I know there's some dairies that hardly follow it, if at all. I'm not going to add much to the kind of discussion that's already out there, and I think the Cornucopia Institute, if you check their website, has some excellent information about that, and I just point you to their website. Anybody else? Well, it's good that you bring him up because once before when I gave a presentation about organic farming history, I neglected to say anything about him, and I should, because he was involved and he wrote articles for Organic Farming or Organic Gardening and Farming magazine. So he was part of the organic movement. I don't think Albrecht was someone that had the view that chemical fertilizers needed to be absolutely prohibited. I do sort of indirectly mention him through Acres USA because Acres USA magazine was a very prominent publisher and proponent of his approaches. So he's definitely an important figure. Anybody else? Okay, and I think that we'll have to move on to the next speaker. So our next speaker is Dr. Hugh Campbell, and I need to switch this over.
I wish I applaud you for.
Oh, thank you.